Hello, Movie Marathoners, and welcome to episode 82 of the Movie Marathoners podcast, part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mati, and joining me this week is film critic Erica Richards, whose writing can be found on sites such as In Their Own League, CRP Writes, and In Session Film. Erica, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me.
I'm so excited to be back. It feels like forever ago that we talked, but it really hasn't been that long.
Yeah, I know. It has been about a month. You were on the podcast to talk about One Night in Miami and Promising Young Woman. And I guess, you know, for podcast standards, that's like what, like 3 or 4 episodes ago? So not that long, but it does feel like quite a while ago. So much has happened since then, just everywhere.
Yeah, I feel like so much has happened since then. Wait, you know what I do want to ask you about that we haven't talked about is how was your Sundance experience?
Oh, Sundance was great. I kind of worked myself a little too hard, I would say. Like, I just like did so many of these mini review podcasts, and hopefully people appreciated those. But it was a ton of fun. It was my first experience at a film festival, so that was super exciting. And honestly, I just next year really hope that it's back in person and I can somehow figure out how to get off of work and go, because I think the one thing that was missing was that like community aspect. And it was a little harder to feel that when you're just sitting at home on your couch the whole time. But I know you just got accredited for South by Southwest, right?
I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Which is will also be my first film festival. I covered last year. Yeah. Last year through their league, I covered a couple like documentaries here and there, but not full like accredited. Like you said, I'm taking a few days off work. I'm like fully, you know, doing it. And I also would love to be in person. I think it's just a different experience, but obviously like that's not the reality of the world right now. I also am planning to apply for Sundance next year and hope I can go and we can all be there in person, which would be awesome. And then of course the same for South by Southwest next year as well. So yeah. So I'm super excited. I'm just looking forward to like seeing a bunch of new stuff and getting the chance to write about it. So I'm super, super thankful to In Session Film for that, because they're the ones that got me in. So super, super thankful to them.
Yeah, I'm really excited for you for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. I didn't apply because I was like, oh man, I don't know if I can do another one like a month after.
Right.
So kudos to the people who are doing both. It's not my job though. So I think when it's someone's job, I think they're a little more capable of banging them out.
Yeah. Well, any suggestions you have, I will take. So we can talk offline about how to survive, you know, watching however many films in a span of 3 or 4 days. So any suggestions you have, I will take.
Yeah, we'll talk about it for sure.
Okay.
In the meantime, what we're going to talk about today, this episode is a normal marathon episode featuring a full-length review of one of the Oscar frontrunners, Nomadland, which is currently streaming on Hulu. Before heading to the start line, though, we'll warm up with a film news segment. Then we'll have a spoiler-free discussion of Nomadland before heading into spoiler territory where we can talk freely about the film. And then finally, as always, we'll round out the episode with our point two section where we discuss what else we've been watching. So, okay, let's go ahead and warm up with some film news right off the bat, and we'll do that by heading to the trailer track. So last week, we got the first trailers to two very different but still very high-profile films, Disney's Cruella and Warner Bros. Mortal Kombat. So I figured we'd start with Cruella. I think that's the one that you're most excited for, Erica. Cruella is an origin film for the villain of Disney's 101 Dalmatians. It's, of course, Cruella de Vil. I think she's an iconic villain. It stars Emma Stone as Cruella, or pre-Cruella de Vil, I guess. And it's directed by Craig Giuseppe, who most recently directed I, Tonya, which I'm a huge fan of. The film is allegedly going to be released in theaters on May 28th. We'll see. I feel like that's pretty ambitious, but who knows? Maybe they're going to go for a theatrical release. Who knows? But Erica, what are your thoughts on the trailer and the project?
I've been excited about this for a really long time. I love Emma. Like, I remember when this got announced like forever ago. I think like it was just announced and I was like, whoa, this is on my radar. Like, I'm super excited for this. A huge Emma Stone fan. I think she's like the perfect casting for this. I'm excited by the trailer. I just think like and I'm sure we'll get into it, but, and I kind of made like a joke tweet about it last night that I'm just so sick of everything being compared to the Joker. Mm-hmm. I'm so sick of it. Like, she's her own villain. And yes, there's some like parallels or whatever, but like, just because it's like a villain origin story, which like, I love the Disney villains, like, where's my Ursula origin story? I need that next. You know, I'm super excited for it. Like, it looks fun. It looks like campy. I don't know. Like, I'm here for it. I was not here for everyone comparing it to the Joker, but I'm here for it. And like I said, the joke tweet like I made last night was I watched Eyes Wide Shut for the first time last night.
Oh, okay.
The Stanley Kubrick film. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but I made a joke that it's so long. It's like, it felt so long. I made a joke because there's a scene early on in the film when Nicole Kidman character's Alice is arguing with Tom Cruise. They're arguing, right? They're a couple, they're a married couple, and they're arguing. And she's in like a white tank top and like white underwear. And it looked exactly like how Marie Zendaya looked in Malcolm and Marie, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm like, oh, is this the like source, or is this the inspiration for Malcolm and Marie? Like, joking, obviously, because there's so many parallels in film, right? Like, mm-hmm. and I love finding those parallels and those like similarities and inspirations and stuff. But just because something, you know, finds inspiration from another film, or it looks like another film, or it's also a villain story, or it's also a story about a couple, right? Doesn't mean it's exactly the same thing. Or, you know, Cruella's her own person, you know?
So I mean, did you not enjoy Joker? Like, you don't, do you not like it?
I feel like Joker is really controversial. You either loved it or hated it. And I'm that weird person that's like in the middle. Mm-hmm. I thought Joaquin Phoenix was like incredible and very deserving of the Oscar. Like, I thought he played, like, I thought he was incredible. It's not a film that I'm like excited to revisit. I've seen it once, like, cause I always do like the Oscar, yeah, you know, like prep thing. It's a wild watch. I thought it was good. I mean, again, like, I thought it was good. Like, I thought it was well done. I think so many people, like I said, are either like firmly on one side or the other. And I'm like a weirdo that's in the middle. Cause I thought it was a good watch. I don't really want to revisit it. And I thought Joaquin Phoenix was incredible. So I'm in this weird in between, I think. What about you? Are you a fan of it, or?
I liked it, I would say. I think the discourse around it made it really exhausting, and I enjoyed my time watching it. And I was actually pretty skeptical going into it, because I think that the Joker and like the whole idea of the Joker is kind of overrated and overplayed anyways. So it pleasantly surprised me, but I think similarly to you, I was just like, look, it's a good performance. It's, you know, if we're going to get superhero movies, then you might as well get one where Joaquin Phoenix gets to deliver a good performance.
Yeah.
So I think in comparing Cruella to that aspect of Joker, I think it sort of makes sense. Like, okay, you've got this villain, you know, villain origin story, and we have a good actor in the lead role, and maybe this is just their time to get to have fun and give a good performance. So, again, I mean, I agree with you. It's a very surface level comparison.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure it's going to be completely different. This is obviously going to still be a kid's film, and Joker is absolutely not.
Do you think it's going to be a kid's film? It's funny that you say that, because I was watching it and I'm like, this doesn't look like a kid's film, which obviously, like, I'm fine with, but like, yeah, and to bring it back to Cruella, right? Not to change the whole subject and make it all about the Joker, but
Joker pod.
I know, right? I was watching it thinking, like, this looks dark. But also, I'm the kind of person, too, that's like, all Disney films are secretly dark. And, like, you just don't really realize it until later. You're like, there was some messed up shit in Lion King. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Well, I feel like this is going to be a kid's movie in the same way that something like Pirates of the Caribbean, which is certainly PG-13, it's certainly pretty violent, but it still is for children, or like families, I guess.
Okay.
Like, this is still a Disney film, right? It's not going to be their gritty R-rated take on the 101 right. Dalmatians, you know?
I would love to see that. But I don't know. I'm excited. I thought Emma Stone looked incredible. Like, mm-hmm. we see her with like the red hair in the beginning, and then she's like fully transformed by the end. I will say I only watched the trailer once because I'm not really a big trailer person. I try to stay away from them. But again, I'm super excited for this one. This has been on my radar forever. Actually, a few months ago, I tweeted like, is Cruella still happening? Like, I haven't heard anything about it. And then it's like, you know, the trailer came out. So I'm excited. I'm excited. I think it's going to be super fun. Is it also releasing on Disney Plus or no, just in theaters?
It seems like it's just theaters, which I think is kind of bizarre.
I
know that they're also still pretty adamant about the Black Widow release date, which is even earlier than this. My guess is they'll probably change their tune, but we'll see. I think I'm also excited for this, but also I feel like every single live action Disney movie has had a great trailer. And then I watch the movie and I'm like, this is some level of garbage. So I'm starting to feel like, okay, fool me once, fine. Fool me twice, fine. Fool me thrice, apparently still fine because I went to go see, I paid $30 for fucking Mulan. But like, fool me a fourth time.
I still haven't watched Mulan. Were you disappointed?
I was very disappointed. And I think that trailer looked amazing. I love Nikki Caro. It was just super disappointing.
Really? Why?
Well, you can listen to our episode. No, I'm just kidding. I just found that the story was really inconsistent and like it just was really choppy. None of the characters had anything to them other than maybe sort of the Mulan character, but it didn't have any of the fun of the animated one. And then it didn't do enough to make itself like this badass kind of war epic that it could have been by just
kind of adhering.
And
that it looked in the trailer. It looked that way in the trailer. Yeah.
Yeah. So I found that super disappointing. It's definitely one of the more ambitious ones. But you know, I mean, even like Lion King, which is my favorite movie ever, probably. That live action one is just brutal.
I didn't see that one either because I was just like, I don't think I've seen a live action Disney remake. What other ones are there? Because I didn't see Lion King. I didn't see Mulan. I just was like, I don't want to see a live action Lion King. Like the original is so good. Like, I don't know. That's the other thing too is like, I think I appreciate these like origin stories, right? Because it's not a remake. They're not doing like a remake of like the 101 Dalmatians, right? But they're kind of using that source material to create something new. And it seems like everything now is a remake or a reboot, which is just so annoying. Like, can we get some original stories, you know? Like, I don't know. So I think, again, like, I'm excited. I think it looks good. I hope it meets my expectations. I'm nervous. It's also the co-writer of the Favorite, which I'm like hoping that helps it. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't want to keep being like the storm cloud on your parade, but I guess my question for you then is the one that's probably most comparable to this is Maleficent with Angelina Jolie. And
I
hated that one too. So
really? Okay. I didn't see that either.
I think I'm just sort of protecting myself from disappointment. I'm definitely going to watch this. I will watch anything that has like IP that I recognize from my childhood. So they've got me, but I just hope that this one is good. And you know what? Maybe it is the one that's good. And there's a couple that are good. I thought Cinderella was great.
And Beauty and the Beast. Okay. Mm-hmm, yeah. No, I love Beauty and the Beast is my favorite from my childhood. So yes, I loved that Beauty and the Beast remake. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Let's cross our fingers.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. So fingers crossed, Cruella is good in May, and we actually get to see it in May. But who knows? The other high-profile trailer drop that we got was the first trailer for Warner Brothers' Mortal Kombat movie. And that is a remake or a reboot or something, because there are Mortal Kombat movies. There's a film series of them, apparently. I haven't actually seen any of them. But all of those films are also, of course, adaptations of the Mortal Kombat video game, which is a fighting style game. You pick a character and you fight the other character. So this film is scheduled for release on April 16th. And like all the Warner Brothers films for 2021, it's going to be released in theaters and HBO Max simultaneously. So at the very least, we know that we will be getting this movie, even if we don't necessarily get any of the theatrical releases. Right. So this new Mortal Kombat trailer, Erica, you we started this Zoom call and you were like, oh my God, I forgot to watch this. So
obviously I'm super excited about Mortal Kombat, super pumped for it, super on my radar. I know nothing about any of this. I know it's a video game and that's like as much knowledge as I have. And like maybe like seeing a few guys in college like playing it, which college for me was Jesus, like 10 years ago. So like I literally know close to nothing. The trailer looked cool. I mean, like, you saw me watch it and I was like, okay, this looks cool. Like, you know, I mean.
Yeah, you looked perplexed a little bit at times.
I was like, there was just so much happening, I feel like. I don't know. And so much, I guess it's just so much that I don't know. I don't know. It looked, again, I think it looked cool. I'll be honest with you. Like, those types of films, and not to like sound like an asshole when I say that, like those types of films, like, they're just not my thing. Will I watch it? Maybe, because it's on HBO Max and I have HBO Max, like maybe I'll watch it to see what it's about. Like, I don't know. It looks cool. And I think I've seen a lot of people who are super into the video games saying like, this looks awesome. Like, I did feel like I saw a lot of like, the trailer looks amazing. So like, good for those people. I don't know. Like, I have close to nothing to say about this because I have no investment in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is not a video game series I'm super familiar with. I think the things I know about it are that it's ultra violent. And when you're about to win, the voice of the video game says, finish him. And then you perform like a certain combo or whatever. And you get this really ultra graphic kill of your opponent. So like, if you're one character, they'll like rip the spine out of the person. Or, you know, if you're the Sub-Zero guy who freezes people, it'll make like this hailstorm of ice that just stabs everybody or whatever. So the trailer had that. It was an ultra violent trailer, and there was a guy that screamed, finish him. And then we got a cut of a bunch of people killing people very violently. So it seems to have what the video game series is known for. It'll be interesting to see if there's anything that's kind of vaguely plot related, which I think is where these video game series movie adaptations really struggle. For this one, I think if it's just a bunch of people fighting and it's relatively good and it's not like shitty basic action, then I don't think it needs that much of a plot. So maybe this will be good. I'm not, again, I'm like more kind of protect myself from disappointment, and I'm going to watch it because like you said, it's free on HBO Max. So the trailer, I thought, didn't dissuade me from watching it, I guess is the way I can put that.
That makes sense. I just, it's not my, it's just not, I mean, like, no, I don't mean any shade when I say like, but it's just not my thing. So it looks fine, it looks cool. I mean, like, I think I have such an appreciation for those types of films because there's so much that goes into making them,
right?
But I don't really have a desire to watch them, if that makes sense. So we'll see.
As Erica said, we'll see about Mortal Kombat when it comes out in April. But let's go ahead and move on to our main review of Nomadland, which very much is your type of movie, I think, Erica.
Yes, it is.
So first, a synopsis. After losing everything in the Great Recession, a woman embarks on a journey across the American West, living as a van-dwelling modern-day nomad. Nomadland stars Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, and it is written and directed by Chloe Zhao.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am, I know.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom said that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
No.
My husband worked at the USG mine in Empire. I was a substitute teacher.
It is a tough time right now. You may want to consider early retirement.
I need work. I like work.
So Nomadland has had buzz ever since it premiered at the Venice Film Festival last September. So it's been in the public conscience for many, many months. It's been the recipient of tons of awards from all sorts of critic circles and awards groups, and I would say it is one of, if not the front runner for Best Picture. And it was also the film that was most often ranked as the best film of 2020 from film critics and such.
Yeah.
But it has remained relatively difficult to see until last weekend when it was released publicly to Hulu or on Hulu. So just like Promising Young Woman, we talked about this last month. This was a film that I have waited to see for months, and it felt like I was the very last person in the entire world to see it. But I know, Erica, you have a little bit different of a story of when you saw Nomadland. So what was that like?
Yeah, so I also, you know, being a part of like the film critics world and seeing all the buzz about it, I'm like, I have to see this film. Like, same, I think I probably said this about Promising Young Woman too. It got to the point where I'm like, I have to reach out to get a screener. Like, I have to. Mm-hmm. Not the same so much with Nomadland. I was able to snag a ticket through Film at the Lincoln Center. I think I paid like $12, like, which, you know, when I think about like renting Promising Young Woman for $20 after I'd seen it twice already, you know, $12 is nothing. So I was just thankful that I could snag a ticket. Also, just, and I know we're not talking about this, but just the same thing. I just recently snagged a ticket through like the A24 screeners for Minari. And I paid $20 for that, which again, like I'm super okay with paying something like $20 because I want to support as much as I can right now during these times, you know? And yeah, I saw it back in December. I was really glad to see it then because I don't know if I could have waited until now. So I feel your pain. I feel your pain. Like it's excruciating to see everyone talking about it. And, you know, it was hard to get screeners too. So one of the sites I write for, CRP writes, when they'd seen that I got I'd snagged a ticket, they were like, do you want to write a review? Cause like we need a review of this. So like I'd written my review way back then. And yeah, I don't think I've changed at all my review. I think, you know, it's so touchy. Like you never really know what's going to win Best Picture. But like you said, like Nomadland has gotten so many awards. It's so good. Like I know we'll get into it and talk about it, but.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and give your overall thoughts right now? Just what do you think overall about it?
So first of all, I'm in the like campaign. I'm like the campaign manager of like put Frances McDormand in every film. I'm obsessed with her. I love her. I think she's phenomenal in everything I've ever seen. And she's also like one of those women that like, I want to be her friend. Like I want to know her. She just seems like an amazing person. And she's just so, especially in this, she's so infectious and like so vulnerable and charming and just infectious. Like I just fell in love with her character, Fern. And I just think she's incredible. But I think Nomadland, I'll kind of preface with this. I'm a documentary nerd. Like I love documentaries. If you ask me what my favorite genre is, I first ask you, do you consider documentaries a genre? And if you say yes, then I say documentaries. If you say no, then I say thrillers, because like mystery thriller type of, you know, things are my favorite, like genre, but like I live for a documentary. So I loved that aspect of this, is that so often it felt like you were watching a document. You felt like you were just watching Frances McDormand, like surrounding a documentary film. I don't know. That's the way it kind of came off to me. I love the use of like non-professional actors, which is something that, you know, I think is really hard to do. I think that's also why Chloe Zhao, I never am sure if I'm saying it right.
I think it's Zhao.
Zhao.
Yeah.
That's also why I think she's getting so many director nods, because to be able to get these performances out of these non-professional actors that, you know, who knows how much of it was scripted, unscripted, or, you know, whatever, but to get these performances out of them, that is about direction, right? Creating a space where they're comfortable and giving them the space to be these fictionalized versions of themselves and do it so well. Like, I'm like looking up these people after the fact. Like, I'm also like well, this is a spoiler, so I won't say it. But probably the only spoiler that it could be in the film, but we'll get there, but I won't say it yet. But I'm like looking up these people after the fact because I was also thinking, like, were they non-professional? Like, they were so good. Yeah. Who is this person, you know? And like I said, I just think like Frances McDormand's ability to mold and gel with these people is just incredible to watch. This is a film that I think I will tell everyone to watch, but I think it's also one of those films that I think certain people like wouldn't have appreciation for, right? Yeah. I've even heard some other people like, I don't know, it just kind of looks like Frances McDormand's just like wandering around. I'm like, yeah, it is, but like it's so much more than that. And she's so incredible, right? I'm like, I could watch her shit in a bucket for hours. Like, I love her. And she's just so infectious in this film. Like, this time around watching it, like, I felt so different about her character. I felt like she was so, I didn't realize like how strong she was, you know, like she's like keeping it together so well when she could have broke so many times, you know, and it's so good. I think it'll win Best Picture. I think it's got a really, really good chance.
Yeah, for sure. I'll echo a lot of what you said. I agree. I think Frances McDormand is sensational in this. She's always sensational, but I agree that this performance has a gentleness and like a tenderness that I was kind of surprised to get from her, especially because her last flashy performance, of course, was the what's her name in Three Billboards, right?
Yeah, so good.
She's more curmudgeon-y in that, and then she kind of played into that curmudgeoniness on the awards circuit. So it was surprising to see her play a more gentle and quiet character, and I really found that performance very captivating. The thing that you mentioned, I guess we should just be specific about what we were saying with the non-professional actors, is that Chloe Zhao uses non-professional actors to play fictional versions of themselves in this film. She does it in her previous two films as well. And, you know, the obvious exception is Frances McDormand and then the David Strathairn character. But all the other actors, and especially the nomads, are people that are actually nomadic people, and they're playing fictional-ish versions of themselves. And I really want to talk about some of the, like, what we think is scripted versus not scripted, because I think that screenplay is, like, the more I think about it, the more I read about this movie and how it was created, the screenplay kind of blows my mind. But it is a little spoilery, so we will save it for that. But, I think this film, it's an odd film for sure, because as you're saying, and maybe this is why you like it so much, it feels a lot like a documentary. And I would say it's almost like 60% a documentary about these nomads, and then 40% a story about Frances McDormand's character. But it feels like for the first, I would say, hour of the movie, it's like 90% documentary, 10% Frances McDormand character. And then the last part of the film, it kind of switches and becomes more about the Frances McDormand character. So I found that the film was pretty slow. It meanders very intentionally. And I think ultimately at the end of the film, I really enjoyed it. And I thought the ending was phenomenal. It definitely took its time to kind of work its magic on me. And I agree with you that I think there will be certain people who, for better or for worse, will look at this and be like, I'm a little bored. And I'm not of the camp that's like saying a movie's boring is bad criticism. I think just saying that it's boring is bad criticism. But if you can explain why, and then, you know, I think movies are meant to be entertaining. And it's certainly fair to watch this one and be like, well, this is not necessarily what I'm looking for. So just for people listening who haven't seen it, it is a slow and quiet movie. But I do think that this idea of these slow and quiet moments and the collective sum of those moments making something beautiful is very emblematic of life. And that's the thing that I think won me over with this film.
Yeah. And you know what? I will say that this second watch, I thought about things a lot differently. Like, even from the very opening, like as soon as the film opens, there's text on screen that explains, like, you know, this town in Nevada Empire, right? Which is where,
isn't it in Nebraska? I think it's Nebraska.
Oh, Nebraska. Sorry.
How dare you mix up those two? I'm just kidding, that's fine.
You know, it was I think it was like a drywall company or something, and it shut down. And then it was like, then what did it? It said something like, then the zip code was like no more, right? Like the town like was taken off the map, essentially, right?
Yeah. So it was like the main source of jobs for this small town. And so when the company dissolved, there were no jobs. So everyone was like, all right, let's leave. Right. And so then the town was like, well, we don't have any people, so we're not a town anymore. And I think it dissolved,
right,
other than the few people that wanted to stay there. And then they became nomads, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So that was really interesting to me, too. And I kind of was reflecting on, like, because, right, I think the overall message in this film is, you know, what defines home for you, right? And I really, that line that Frances delivers where she's like, I'm not homeless, I just don't have a house, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is like, there's so much behind what she's actually saying there. And this whole like zip code, like, you know, this the whole zip code thing, right? And I'm saying that because I come from a place where your zip code does matter. Like you are judged by where you live and what zip code you're in. Like literally, you're judged by that. And mm-hmm. I'm a huge proponent of like, it does not matter where you live or, you know, what your zip code is. It does not define you, right? Because like, if you've grown up around here and you meet someone, their first question they're going to ask you is, what high school did you go to? Which defines where you grew up, right? Mm-hmm. And you are judged based on where you went to high school, okay? Essentially what zip code you fell under, right? And I always say, because there's a road that you can take from Baltimore to Annapolis, okay? So all in between there, everyone shares this road. And I always say, like, you are not better than me. We all share Ritchie Highway because that's the road, right? So it's like funny because people will define where you live based on this like road, right? And I'm just like, you're not better than me because you went to, I won't call it out, XYZ high school, right? And it's also one of those things, like, if I say to someone, like, oh, I went to XYZ high school, they're like, what? You did? Like, they judge me. They immediately judge me for it. So I when I saw that on screen this time, I was like, oh, that's so meaningful, right? Like, mm-hmm. we judge people based on where they live and grew up and where they're from and where they consider home, right? And something also that I was thinking about was, why are things different based on like also age, right? And like where you're at in your life? Because I'm sure you and I both have had friends who have, after college or maybe in between college years, have purchased a van and decided to trek across country. And, or like, I'm gonna do this, like, you know, camping thing for 3 months. And it's always like, that's so cool, right? Mm-hmm. Why is it because these people are choosing to live this way when they're older, because we as a society think retirement should be luxurious and on a beach or, you know, whatever. And these people who are older, who are choosing to live this way, why do we look at it as sad or unfortunate, right? Because like, think about those people she meets in the beginning who are like, are you okay? You know, like, or you can come stay with us. Or even that younger girl that says, like, my mom says you're homeless. Like, are you okay? You know, whatever she says. And she's like, I'm not homeless, I just don't have a house, you know? And it's like, it's the same thing I think I saw like a Twitter thread like a while ago that was like, what is something that's considered cool if you're rich, but not if you're poor? And it was like, knowing multiple languages, right? When someone who is educated and wealthy knows multiple languages, we're like, ooh, that's so sexy. But when it's someone who is like an immigrant or like not very well off and they know multiple languages because they have to get by, we don't even think about that, right? It's like the same kind of thing for me with this. I realized it was like, people are looking at these people like, oh, they don't have much and it's so sad. Look at them and they're further along in their life and they don't have anything. When in reality, if it was a 22-year-old, we'd be like, that's so cool. They're going to like see the wilderness and you know, experience things. And it's like, these people are doing the same exact thing. And it's just because of their age that we're judging them, I think, you know?
Yeah, you're bringing up an interesting point that I think the movie does a really good job at towing a line about, is this idea of whether these people really have a choice in the lifestyle that they are choosing. And I think on some level, yes, they do. The film goes and says, okay, let's look at this Fern character. She has the ability to stay with friends or even family if she wants to. But there also is this sort of disconnect, I think, between what these people do versus what a 22-year-old who just graduated college with a good degree, probably not a lot of student debt, decides to be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use my privilege to explore this lifestyle. And I think how you interpret this film is really interesting to think about, like, how much of this film is saying this is an opportunity that these people have versus this is what they have to do. And there's a lot of moments in this film where it definitely doesn't glorify this lifestyle. But then there is certainly an aspect of this film where you watch it, at least from like a place of relative privilege, like we are, where we have a home and we watch and we say, oh man, it would be so nice to go to these beautiful scenic landscapes. Oh man, right. I'm from Arizona. So when they go to Quartzsite, I'm like, I just want to be home right now. I love the desert. Looks so beautiful. So there is that wish fulfillment-ish part of this movie, and how those two coalesce in this movie is really interesting. And I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure what my takeaway about that message is, but I like that the film kind of toes that line very delicately, and you can have both.
Right, right. And I think, you know, kind of like you said, as the film develops, you start to learn more about these non-professional actors, right? And these characters, and maybe why they're on the road, or just things about their life that have kind of defined who they've become. And I agree with you. I think it toes a line, and it, you know, its message could be interpreted differently by different people. I'd love to watch it again and see what I pick up on differently this time, because I think the first time I watched it, I didn't necessarily think about these other things that I'm talking about now. Like, even that opening, like I said, that text on screen, like the second time I watched it, I'm like, do I even remember that happening the first time? You know, like, I'm like, oh. And I think, you know, I always think you should watch a film twice because you pick up on so much. But I was like, oh, wow. You know, and I think it really, you know, is also kind of like a back and forth of the American dream, right? Like, the American dream is to travel and see all these wonderful places. And another thing that I love about, the direction and the cinematography of this film is that they shoot and compose the shots of the beautiful outdoor, you know, sceneries the same way they do an Amazon warehouse, right? And I think what is the message there is that, like, this is the American dream, right? Like, these beautiful landscapes and, like, the traveling and the, you know, getting to see the world, but also, like, the reality of a lot of American lives is spending their days in these huge warehouses. And I think that's something, again, this is like kind of what I'm saying, like, where people that I think are just watching a film surface level for entertainment, like you're saying, they're not going to pick up on these things, right? Like, they're giving us a message here that, like, you want to see these beautiful landscapes, and in reality, you're in a huge warehouse. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that how you interpret this movie is going to be very largely dependent on what you think of not only this lifestyle, but sort of just the more traditional American lifestyle. And what I think is really, I don't know if smart is necessarily the right word for this, but certainly what is good for the universality of this film is that the film doesn't really take a harsh stance in any one thing. Like, I think it introduces a lot of these aspects, but it doesn't say this is bad and this is good. It actually, like, you know, when this movie opens and it pans at the Amazon warehouse, I'm a person who definitely still uses Amazon, but I know that they're pretty shitty to their employees. And yeah. So immediately when it comes on, me and my girlfriend were like, oh, this is going to be like an anti-corporate kind of film, kind of like an F you to Amazon. And you can certainly read the film like that. You can show that, look, Amazon is using these people who need temporary work. And then once the Christmas season is over, they're like, all right, we don't need you anymore. So see you later. But then you could also read it as like, this is Amazon providing a job opportunity for these people. And so depending on what your thoughts are, the film kind of validates both. And I think in terms of like an Oscar chance film, like a film that needs to appeal to a wide group of people, I think that apolitical-ishness of this film is pretty beneficial to it for being like, you know, it is certainly can be read on a liberal lens, but it can also be read on a conservative lens. And like, look at all these great people that are stuck in middle America and all of this stuff. So I find that a pretty unique aspect of this film in that it's more just kind of like wholesome, feel-good stuff instead of being like, oh, let's thoroughly examine capitalism through these people who were left behind because of capitalism, you know?
Right. I absolutely agree. I don't know if I even thought at first, you know, it's very early in the film that it's going to be that controversial. But now that you make that point, I think maybe I could have thought that.
I thought that it like has the potential to be controversial, but it's not.
Yeah, I agree. And like you said, I think it really delicately explores that, right? Like, I think these nomads are appreciative for these like little odds and ends jobs, and they're okay with that. And they're, I think another thing that I picked up on the first time I watched it, and then again the second time, was like, these people are all really hard workers. Like, they really care about doing a good job, right? Like, they're not like a useless teenager who doesn't really care. You know what I mean? They're like, I thought about like when they were like cleaning the bathrooms in that one place, or like, you know, just anything that they were doing, right? Like, they were doing it with intention. And I think they're thankful for these, like I said, these little odd jobs wherever they go, wherever they can find work. And again, would we be thinking differently if this was like a group of 25-year-olds, right? Like, would we be like, oh, that's cool, like they pick up a job here and there? Or like, you know, people that I won't say that I grew up with, but like when I, like during college, like I lived, my college wasn't far from like our beach here in Maryland. And my family has a beach house, and I would live there in the summers and wait tables and bartend, and it was super fun. And, you know, but it wasn't like my career, right? Like, I always joke that like I would love to be a like career waitress because you just bring people food and make them happy. But, you know, how do we treat these people that are in these jobs? It's not always steady work. Mm-hmm. It's not always, you know, I mean, look now with like the pandemic, like we're saying these people are heroes and are frontline workers. And like, we're debating whether or not they deserve to have a minimum wage raise, you know? But I also think about like, again, these people that either I went to school with or that had gone to school like in my area or whatever, and then graduated, and then, okay, I'm going to bartend here in the summers, and then I'm going to go live out in Utah in the winters and teach snowboarding. Like, and it was like, oh, that's so cool. Again, like, why are we looking, like, I think the first time I watched this, I think I felt like a little sad for these people. And then the second time I'm like, no, this is their life, and they're like figuring it out and like making it work. And they've chosen this life, you know, like you said, like there's opportunities here where these people could have homes, or even like Swanky, which I don't want to like spoil anything here, but Swanky, like, you know, some of these people are ill and they're like, I don't want to be in a hospital. I don't want to be indoors. I want to be out with nature and live until I am no longer on Earth, you know, which I think is like a really meaningful message, and her character, you know, there's a lot to be said there. So
yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about those specific kind of supplementary characters in spoilers. I think before doing that, I just want to talk about the performances a little bit more here in the non-spoiler section. I want to talk PRs. This is a new segment of the podcast where we ask if this film is anyone's best performance, or to use the running related term, their personal record. So, I mean, the obvious question here is we've got this amazing Frances McDormand performance. Erica, do you think that this film is her PR?
You know, it's funny because, like I've said, I feel like I love Frances McDormand. I'm a huge fan of her work. But I was thinking about it. I'm like, I really haven't seen, like, I mean, she's been in so many films, right? But this performance and this character is so different, like you said, so different from anything she's ever played, right? Like, I love her character in Fargo. Like, I thought she was hilarious and, like, so good in that role. And then her character in Three Billboards, which, you know, again, she won an Oscar for. God, she was, like, electric in that. She was so good. And then this, like you said, it's a much more delicate, quiet, but so infectious. Like, she was so, like, I don't even know if, like, charismatic or charming is even the right word. She just was so... what is the right word, Maddie? Like, she's so, like, I don't even know.
For me, there are several moments in this film where I'm like, she is just the sweetest, most adorable little lady ever. And I don't think I've ever experienced that with a Frances McDormand character.
Right.
Normally, she kind of plays a badass.
Yes.
And it's not that Fern isn't a badass. Like, in her own way, she is. But there is this sort of, like, vulnerability to her character in this. That is just like, I want to give her a hug, you know?
Yes. And also, like, moments too where she was just like fun, like naturally funny. And I think, I don't know if it's also because you're watching her and you know Frances McDormand, right? Like, you know her, she's very famous. And you're watching her with these non-professional actors and you're watching her just be so natural with them. Or even, like, for me, honestly, I was thinking, like, what was my favorite scene? For me, it was the scene with the alligator.
Yeah. And
she was just like, her reaction would be my reaction. So, like, I just, like, felt like I saw myself in her in that moment. Like, you know, like, I don't know. She's just so I don't to say, like, is this her best performance? It's tough because I think she's so good in those other roles that she's, you know, won Oscars for. But again, I think she has a huge chance of winning again here just because you can't, it's one of those things, like, you can't take your eyes off of her, and not in a way that's, like, flashy or exploited, because I don't even think she has makeup on, you know what I mean? Like, she just was so raw and, like, stripped down and just, sweet, vulnerable, but also, like, never going to give in. And, like, you know, I don't know. Do you remember the moment when the character Dave, who's the only other non-professional actor, he picks up that box, like, he's trying to help her with her stuff. When he picks up that box and all the stuff falls out of it and breaks, when I tell you I gasped and jumped, like, I never have in a horror film. Or anything, you know what I mean? Because you just know how much those things mean to them because it's literally all they have. And he just, like, that too, like, he was so good at, like, I just felt like you felt so much emotion because he was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And she's just like, go over there, like, get, you know, it's just like, I feel like that was so real. And, like, not that it's, like, this big acting moment, right? Like, it's not, it was just, when something so simple, like I said, can give me so much of a reaction, like, I literally was like, oh my God. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's a performance, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So it's, like, hard because, like, to say, is this her best role? Because I think she made so much out of, I don't want to say so much out of nothing, but, you know, with the character, like, she had in Three Billboards, like, she was this, like, really diving into, like you said, being this, like, badass and, like, give no fucks kind of woman, where I think you can play it more into that, where being a real, you know, quote unquote real person or, like, this nomad.
That's true. Yeah.
It's so much deeper in a different way. So, oh gosh, I don't know. It's like the Oscar race is going to be so interesting this year because there's so many, like, I think about, like, I always fill out a ballot, right? And I always do, like, who I think the Academy is going to choose and then who I want. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, for me, it's like, of course, like I've been obsessed with Promising Young Woman and I wanted that to win all the awards and I want Carrie to win Best Actress, but I would not be upset if Frances McDormand wins again, you know?
Yeah. So I won't hold you to this answer, but I'll make you pick. Is this her PR? Yes or no?
Right now I'm going to say, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Again, not to knock this performance at all. You said it perfectly. I just think that Three Billboards performance of hers is such a high watermark of just acting across the board that I think that's going to be incredibly difficult for her to top. So I would say this is not her PR performance, but you know, if you have a world record, it's really hard to get a PR. So, I mean, I agree with everything that you said, just a really wonderful performance. What about Chloe Zhao? I don't know if you've seen her other films, but is this her PR?
So I actually haven't. She really wasn't on my radar until Nomadland. But I am doing a series over at In Session, 52 Films by Women this year. So I'm trying to watch at least one film by a woman every week and then write about it. And I added her film, The Rider. Mm-hmm. To my list. So I will be seeking out her, you know, her other films after this. But so this is all I really have to go on. And I think like, I mean, she has hit just like you said, like the critics and the award season, like it's won so many awards, right? Like,
yeah, I think I saw a statistic that said that she is the most awarded single individual in a single award season in the modern filmmaking era, which is crazy. I know,
just gave me chills, which is amazing. Like, that's incredible. I think she's a front runner for a director as well, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, not to say always, right, because it's not always the case, but a lot of times, I think there's only two times that someone's won Best Director and not Best Picture. I think it was Ang Lee for Brokeback Mountain and I always mess his name up, for Roma. They won Best Director and then didn't win Best Picture.
Yeah, well, I know Argo won Best Picture, right? And Director,
you're right.
He wasn't even nominated. So it happens every now and then, but yeah, it's pretty rare.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so I think, it's one of those things where it's like, I think, because I remember Oscars night, last Oscars, right? When Bong Joon-ho won Best Director, I was like, oh my God, it's happening. It's happened. Like, this is going to win Best Picture, because that's usually what happens. Like, whoever wins Best Director wins Best Picture. I feel like that just happens. So I think she's a front runner for director as well, which is incredible. Like, mm-hmm. We need more women in the conversation. You know, I was really happy with, was it the Golden Globes that have more?
Yeah.
More women. It was like, oh, this is like cooked up in a lab for me, because it was three women and then David Fincher, who, you know, everyone knows I'm obsessed with. And then Aaron Sorkin, mm-hmm. who I don't think he's as good of a director as he is a writer. I think he's an amazing writer. Like, I'm obsessed with, you know, The Social Network, which he wrote, and Moneyball's another one that I'm obsessed with. So I don't think he's as good of a director, but I love him so much as a writer that, you know, that was the Best Director category. And I'm like, oh, this was like, you know, it was Emerald Fennell and Regina King as well in that category. So I'm like, yeah. Three women, first of all, like, you know, I don't do math, but the math says that women have more of a chance of winning here, right?
I think I can validate that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I don't do math. And I just think it's so exciting. I think as weird of a year as 2020 was, I think there were so many good films by women that got more recognition than I think they would have during a normal year of movies, where, you know, these like big blockbuster movies would have gotten more attention than these like indie films that were, you know, written and directed and by women. So I'm so excited. I'll be super excited if she wins director at the Oscars. I think she's a front runner there as well. So I mean, yeah, like I said, I just think her direction with these non-professional actors, I think like that can't go unnoticed. Like, to create a space and create an atmosphere where these non-professional actors are so moving and so good, that I think that has a lot of credit to the director.
Yeah, I completely agree. And everything you just said about that type of directing style is also true in The Writer. So I watched The Writer yesterday because I was like, I have to see this to compare. I really enjoyed it. I think I like it a little bit better than Nomadland even.
Okay.
It's a very similar film in that it tells a very intimate story about these individuals that live in the Badlands of, I believe, South Dakota. And it's just a really amazing film with these performances from these non-actors playing versions of themselves. It's a much more intimate story, I would even say, because the guy who is the lead, he suffers a brain injury, so he can no longer, or not a brain injury, but a head injury, so he can no longer do rodeos, which is kind of like his life purpose. And this guy actually had that happen to him. There's a character in this movie who is a bull rider, and he gets paralyzed from the waist down. And he is actually in this movie playing himself. And it is incredible to watch. So I will say that that is her PR. This one doesn't quite get there for me in the same way, but it's another one of those, like, if you have an amazing performance, it's just not that this one isn't amazing. It's just really hard to top that other amazing performance. So, I'd be interested to know what you think. I think you're going to really enjoy it. So definitely let me know what you think.
I will. I'm excited to watch that one as well. And I think maybe it's also a way for these non-professional actors, whether they're playing, you know, quote unquote, real version of themselves or a fictionalized version of themselves, maybe it's like super cathartic for them too. Mm-hmm. Like there's some type of truth in the story that they're telling. So I think also that's interesting as a director, because that's why I love documentaries so much, because there's so many different ways you can take the story and the way you tell the story. And I think for her as a director to be able to make this like feature film, right? It's not a documentary, but to use these real people and their real stories and their real lives, that's so interesting to me. And that's why I think like not many people could do that. I don't know. And it's different than like a biopic or biopic or however you say it, something something like The Social Network or something like The Trial of Chicago 7 or like Judas and the Black Messiah, where it's very, very,
it's like overplayed for drama, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Where that's why I think Nomadland is so beautiful and pure, because it doesn't do that, right? Like you said, I think some people look at it as slow or boring or whatever, where it's like, it's just if this was a documentary, would you be watching it differently? You know? I actually cried this time. I cried this time watching it when she has that conversation with her sister, like kind of towards the end, that hit me that hit me.
The one other thing I'll say about Chloe Zhao while we're kind of focusing on her direction is that I don't know if you knew this, but she is a Chinese-born filmmaker. She's not American. As far as I know, she has no experience living in this part of the country. She has no personal investment in this group of people, nor in like the Western genre, which both The Writer and Nomadland, and I think her very first film, are kind of neo-Westerns. So I just think her as an example of bucking the trend of like, you know, everyone says writers and directors, they have to write what they know. They have to tell the story that they know. This woman is telling she's telling a story that she did not experience. And I think it makes her direction not only more impressive, but also it like has a really universal feel to it where like, yes, you're getting the authenticity of these characters. And I think it's really smart that she actually uses real life cowboys and real life nomads so that she doesn't have to pull from her own experiences, but it just makes such a unique experience. And I'm really interested to see how, if at all, she plays with that in The Eternals, which is a huge ass Marvel blockbuster that she's going to do next. It's already filmed, you know, like she's not going to use real Eternals. So I'll just be really interested to see if there is any semblance of her personal touch in that big studio machine film. But I mean, I'm really excited for that film, especially after watching these two.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting to see that, because like you said, that's super different from what she's done. And I think, again, that goes back to, as a director, you know, really letting these people, again, even though they're maybe not, it's not a documentary, it's not them telling their exact stories, but creating a space where they can do that. Like, I was thinking last night when I was watching, I was trying to take notes on like what scenes did I think were just improvised, right? Like, and even like those little moments, right, where like there's that woman and it looks like she's kind of teaching, because there's just like people sitting out in like the crowd and she's teaching them about like shitting in a bucket. And I think that part was probably just like, okay, just talk and do your thing and we're just going to record, you know? And as someone
I want to actually talk a little bit more about that in spoilers, because there's some very specific things. So hold on to that. Why don't you just give your overall thoughts on the film and also score it out of 10, and then we'll go straight into spoilers for a little bit.
Yeah, so this is going to, I'm scoring this really high. I'm going to say 9.5. It's like basically perfect. It's just beautiful. I think it's saying so much more than what just meets the eye. Like I said, will recommend this to everyone. My film people, I'll say like, yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, what are you waiting for? But for, you know, non-film people, like, again, I always think about this because like, so many people in my life, like friends and family, they're not film people. Mm-hmm. So for me to say, like, I would tell them like, oh my God, you'd have to watch this. I wouldn't. I would say like, you need to watch this because it's beautiful, and give it a chance and let it be what it is and let it build while you watch it. Because like I said, a lot of my friends and family, they want to be entertained. They want to, you know, watch something that's cookie cutter and follows the filmmaking tropes that they know, right? And this is so different. And I think I would say, like, watch this and give it a chance, you know, like, it's so good. And I think, you know, for those people who wait until the Oscars and wait until things win, like these big awards that they know, right? Because like you and I've said, this has won so many awards already, but I don't think a lot of like the average people really would pay attention to that. But like I remember last year when my friends texted me after the Oscars and was like, so did you see Parasite? And I'm like, oh, I saw it 3 times in theaters. What are you talking about? Like, I've been talking about this film for months, you know? And I was like, should I watch it? I'm just like, oh God. Like, you know, so that's a lot of the people that I think that's more common, right? Like, but that being said, I think Nomadland is a film for everyone. It's just, you have to go into it with a different lens, a different expectation of what kind of story you're going to get. So I will say everyone should watch this. It's a fantastic film, but I don't want to say it's like not for everyone, but I just think certain people will not appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah, very well put. For me, very similar. Overall, I think it's a strong, beautiful film, and it takes its time. There's not set pieces. There's no flashy moments. I would say instead, it's made up of these very quiet and subtle moments or even experiences, and that can sometimes be a little unexciting or meandery, and it certainly is, as you're saying, a very particular type of film, but I do think that if you allow the film to work, then that net effect is a very reflective film, and it feels just so full of life and heart that it's really hard to not recommend this to someone if they're like, should I watch Nomadland? So for me, it's not quite a 9.5, a little bit lower, but it is a 7.5 out of 10, which is very solid for me.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and take a break here. And when we return, we'll hop into quick spoilers. I know we've already been going on for a while, but we just want to hit some quick spoilers. And we'll do that right after this.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, genxgrownup.com.
life sucks as a grown up.
All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right. I've never done it. No.
Right. All right, we are back and talking about spoilers for Nomadland starting now.
That's my secret, Cap. I'm always angry.
So, Erica, I will just cede the floor to you. You were talking just about these kind of specific things that feel so natural, and it feels like, yeah, somebody literally pointed the camera at somebody and said, just do whatever, and then people just talk. There's a couple that I want to highlight, but since I interrupted you before, I want to give it to you.
Yeah, so like I said, I was trying to like take note of these moments that I thought maybe were like fully unscripted, and that moment, you know, where the woman's like talking about this is how you use a bucket in your van. She's like talking to her. It looked like an outdoor classroom, like where all these people were just sitting, like watching her like give this presentation. And I feel like that was definitely unscripted. Just like the natural like laughs too coming from the audience, because she was like kind of making jokes about it. That I feel like was just like, we're just gonna record this and, you know, catch whatever you say. And like, not just, I don't want to say like I'm a filmmaker, but I do work in production in the real world. And a lot of the stories I'm telling are documentaries, end up being documentaries. So a lot of times I'm capturing something and the people that I'm working with are obviously non-professionals, but I'm like capturing what they do. And they're like, okay, so I'm like, just do what you normally do. And we're going to shoot it. And then if I see what you normally do, I'll know like, okay, I need you to do that again. And we're going to shoot it from this angle, or we're going to look at it in this different way, or whatever. Right. So I think, you know, she probably did that in a lot of moments. Or I think about like that moment where Frances McDormand's character Fern, and is it Linda May, the woman with like the longer gray hair?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's Linda May, where they're like driving around that go-kart.
And they're just like chatting.
Yes,
it's like, it's so natural. It's like completely, yes, verite filmmaking. It's crazy.
Yes, and it was so good. And like, again, that's where like, yes, this non-professional actor is just being herself. Like, you assume she's just being herself, right? Like, because she's not a professionally trained actor. And like, Frances McDormand, again, just looks like she's being herself. Now, we don't know, like, Frances could have been like really acting it up there, but it didn't look like it. It just seemed like, again, like, we're just going to roll on this. You guys just chat or like whatever. But, you know, I think, again, going back to that alligator scene, which I just love so much, like, is that Frances McDormand just like genuinely reacting to like this man feeding this like terrifying looking alligator? Because that's exactly how I would have reacted. Her reaction is 1000% how I would have reacted. Or even like the plate smashing thing. And I'm sorry if that was a spoiler earlier, where like,
I think you're okay.
For me, that was like the most shocking moment in the film.
Yeah.
Just unexpected and shocking. And I think when something's so real, or seemingly real, when something like that happens, it is a different like, oh my gosh, because you know, like that plate meant a lot to her. I don't know. It was just like, there's so much more weight when things seem more natural. Is there any like other moments that you think were like probably super unscripted?
So, I mean, the thing I want to say before saying the one that I felt was like definitely unscripted is, if any of these things are not unscripted, like if they are actually scripted, then this is next level screenwriting. Like, yeah. I have never seen anything that feels this verite. And right. So, I mean, you mentioned the crocodile thing. Like, yeah, I guess theoretically they could have Frances McDormand just acting, or I mean, just reacting to the crocodile in real time or whatever. But she's an actor. I mean, I feel like that one definitely probably is scripted, or definitely the plate scene. So even to talk about those scenes as like, wow, it felt so real, is a testament to not only, of course, the performances, but just this screenwriting of like being able to write something that feels so authentic is incredible. The scene that I want to point out is at the very end, when Frances McDormand is talking to Bob Wells, and you know, he's the guy that is kind of the head of the nomad people that meet in Quartzsite. And he gives this like monologue-ish thing of his son passing away.
Yeah.
And what that means for his life. And when I was watching it, I mean, first off, it almost kind of choked me up.
Yeah, I got a little teary-eyed too, yeah.
Yeah, but second off, I was just like, there is no way this is scripted. Like, just the way that he's talking about this, I can't think of a single actor who could do this that convincingly.
Right.
So, I mean, props to Chloe Zhao for being able to recognize that. I was watching an interview with her, and she said something like, if you can't afford a really expensive actor to play a car salesman, you hire a car salesman. And right. So I think that's really smart.
Yeah, give the space to let these people tell their stories in a cathartic way. Like you said, I also think that was super improvised, because you can't speak on those stories unless you've experienced them. And letting real people tell their story, you know, I even think about, like, maybe this is a comparison to, like, and stay with me here, because I'm going to make a point. Did you see Pieces of a Woman, the Netflix film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Best horror movie of the year.
Right. So I, one of like a group chat that I have with other critics that I write with at one of the sites I write for, the person who reviewed it then spoke with the director like after they reviewed it. And they're like, oh my God, I just spoke with the director and I didn't know this was him and his wife's experience that changes everything for me, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm going to chime in here, like, not to be an asshole, but like, you don't make stories like this unless you've experienced something like it. Like, people don't make stories about like heartbreaking things unless it's a way for them to like have a cathartic release. And like, I'm not saying that, again, not saying that Chloe Zhao has these experiences, but I think what makes her directing so amazing is that she gives people that have had those experiences a space to tell that story. And that's why I think it's so good and memorable and real. Like you said, there's no way that anyone could perform something so devastatingly real.
Yeah, either that or Bob Wells is the next freaking Daniel Day-Lewis and he's just chilling out in a trailer somewhere in Arizona. The thing I really want to see is, because I'm sure that this film will be nominated for screenplay, or if it's not, then it's definitely a snub. But if it is, the thing that I like when they show the Academy Award nominees for screenplay is, a lot of the time in the ceremony, they'll have like the page of the script and then show the scene and how it plays out. I would love to see what the screenplay says for some of these scenes and how it actually gets transferred.
Mm.
Because I know that what they did was they first went to these campsites and then they sort of just interviewed people. And basically they just had people filming, people talking. And then allegedly Chloe Zhao used those interviews to impact and change the script. But I would be really interested to know if any of that just raw footage went into the final film, because it definitely does feel sometimes like somebody just asked them a question and then they talked and then it was sort of edited around to get the exact bit that they wanted. I don't know, but I would be really interested to read this screenplay, and I don't think I've read a single screenplay ever. So this would be my first.
Well, I will take this moment to highly suggest to you, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the YouTube channel Lessons from the Screenplay.
I think I've heard of it, but
it's so good. It's one of my favorite YouTube channels, because I'm really fascinated by, here's the screenplay and here's how it played out, you know, in the film. So yeah, definitely check out that YouTube channel. It's really good. But I agree with you. I would love to see, you know, and that's interesting too, because there's the question of like, you know, well, should have one of the non-professional actors have been the main character,
right? Yeah.
And I don't think so, because I think you had to have that, you know, this fictional Frances McDormand character to have a basis of a narrative, right? And then let these non-professional actors in these improvised moments make up the other parts of the film. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think the first half of the film, there definitely is a bit of a disconnect sometimes, where you have these very real performances and these very real people, And then you have Frances McDormand, who you know is acting, which is another nicer word for like faking, I guess, like if you wanted to be more cynical about it. And so for a while, I was like, do I feel comfortable with like her pretending to be these people while these actual people are on the sidelines? And the more that the film goes on and the more that it sort of becomes about this larger idea of what life feels like and this feeling of being stuck and just going through a cycle, I think it matters less. And I think it's more so that like, well, if she made a direct documentary about these nomads, I probably wouldn't be watching it because it wouldn't be nominated for Best Picture. So I found that eventually the film does strike a good balance between those two kind of clashing sides.
Right. I agree. I do want to talk about Swanky.
Yes.
That is one of the things that I was like, afterwards, I was like Googling, like, please tell me this woman's alive.
I was so convinced she was dead, but she's not.
Oh my God. I know. I know, right? Because it feels like a documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God. If, you know, it's not one of those, like, did they kill off Swanky? It's like, oh my God, Swanky better still be alive.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? I just, like, I want to see all, like, I wish it was going to be a normal Oscars because I want to see these people at the awards, you know, like, oh, I would just, that would make me so happy. But her character was one that I fell in love with. And, you know, I think about, again, these like, are these unscripted moments or are they scripted? And these people are, like you said, just like really well unknown actors, really good, you know, unknown actors. Is that moment like when Frances like knocks on Swanky's like van door and she's like really annoyed with her. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is this woman acting? Like, she's good. Like, she really yeah. genuinely seems like annoyed and like, I don't have time for this. Like, that just, that also felt so real too, you know? I love Swanky's character. And I think they did a good job of like, spoiler alert, she's still alive, thank goodness. But making that moment so meaningful, right? Like, of having.
Yeah, right.
This,
in the
like,
movie, she dies though.
Yes,
right.
In the movie, yeah. She dies, and having that full circle moment where she's like, I just love when she, like, Frances gets that video from her of, like, I guess, what were they, bats?
Swallows. Swallows. They're a type
okay.
of bird. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. I'm like, they look like bats. I don't know. And then, you know, just her with, like, the kayak. Like, it was all so sweet and thoughtful, and, like, also I think how, like, real friendships are. And, you know, even like you said, Bob Wells, like him talking at the end, like his moment where he's like, you know, I never really say goodbye because like I know I'm going to see these people again, whether it's down the road or in the afterlife, you know, and I thought that was really beautiful. And, you know, even like Swank, like her saying, like us finding out like that she is sick and that she's like, no, I'm not going to, I've decided I'm going to live this life on the road until I, you know, pass. And, like, I don't want to be in a hospital. I don't want to live that way. And again, like, the message here is we need to not judge people for deciding to live the way they want to live. And I think we're watching, you know, a character like that and we're saying, like, yes, like, get out there, live your life. And, like, it's okay, right? Where I think, like, maybe if that was one of our loved ones, we'd be like, no, like, we're putting you in the hospital so you can get better or whatever. Or, you know, or even just like, again, just the basis of this narrative, right? Where it's like, why are we judging these people that are choosing to live their lives on the road and live out of a van? And, you know, or even think about that moment where Fern doesn't really want to tell these men that are trying to fix her van, like, this is my home. Like, I live in there. Like, she kind of like holds back a little bit from telling them that because mm-hmm. I think she's afraid of being judged. And back to Swanky, like, I love that full circle moment where she has that conversation with Fern saying like, well, hopefully one day, you know, they'll all throw a rock because she loved rocks and like they'll throw rocks in the fire. And then we see them doing that after she passed. And mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
I love those again, like those seem like filmy moments, right? Where like that seems very scripted and like convenient, but it's like, I could also see that really happening in real life, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we could talk about this so much more. There's so many other things that this film is talking about. We've barely scratched the surface. And
yeah.
That is, of course, the definition of a good film. But I think we'll go ahead and move on to the point two section here just to keep the episode at a regularly reasonable amount of editing time for me. But since we're the Movie Marathoners podcast, I want to end our review with a marathon-related question for you, Erica. So let's say you have to run a marathon, and you have to do it with one of Frances McDormand's characters. I've given you three choices. Do you choose to run it with Marge Gunderson, of course from Fargo, Mildred Hayes from Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, or Fern from Nomadland?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I was kind of torn on like what my answer would be. And I'm like, do I go with just like logical, like Marge is pregnant, first of all.
All right.
So I feel like
I was going to pick Marge because she was the youngest, but I forgot she's pregnant.
Right. You're like very pregnant.
Yeah. Sometimes women run marathons pregnant. It's pretty impressive.
That's incredible. I don't know. And then I just think her character in Three Billboards is like, yeah, she's badass. But like, I'm trying to think like if I was running a marathon, like I would need some support. And I don't think she'd leave me in the dust, I think. Like, not in a way that she's like, I only care about myself, because obviously like she cares so much about other people. But like, she's just a badass. And like, I don't think has time for anything. Like, you know, like I don't know. Maybe it's because like, Fern is like so still fresh and new kind of character. And like I said, like you can tell she's like such a hard worker, like when she's working these like odd end jobs, and like she's so resourceful. You see her like fixing things with their van, like, you know, doing things with their van, and like, but she's also like sweet and kind. And like, I don't know. I think I'd have to go with Fern, as much as I love those other two characters. And again, like both badass characters, badass women. But one's pregnant and one, I think, just like wouldn't have time for my shit, because I would definitely need some help running a marathon. definitely. I'm not a long distance runner, if a runner at all. I spin, I do cycling. So that on a bike, I could last. Running, that sounds exhausting. And I also think Fern, like her character, like as independent as she is, I think looks forward to those like friendship moments, right? Where like she has those, that friendship moment with Swanky or with Linda May or, you know, whatever. Yeah, I think Fern for me. What about you?
That's a good choice. And I think you've convinced me of Fern. Like I said, I was going to pick Marge just because she's younger. So I think she'd be a little less likely to have some health problems with this whole thing. So, but you're right. She's pregnant. I don't really want to put her through that. So,
yeah, very pregnant too. Yeah.
And I was going to pick Mildred second, because I was like, look, I guess I don't necessarily need that like emotional support that I feel like Fern would be better at giving. But again, you know, I'd like to become friends with this person. So Fern, I like that choice. I'll second that as well.
Yeah. I like that question. It made me think. It really did.
So let's go ahead and move on to our point two section. We'll just do a brief one here where we talk about some of the other stuff that we've been watching. Mm. So Erica, what have you been watching?
So I have been watching like a bunch of random stuff. Like I said, I watched Eyes Wide Shut for the first time last night. That was interesting. I also learned that that is the longest film production, like holds the Guinness Book of World Records, like longest production.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And is like thought to be the beginning of the end of Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise's marriage, which is just interesting. And then, you know what? Last night, I also watched Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal. Have you seen that? Mm.
Yeah.
I need to rewatch it because I was only half paying attention. I was like trying to do other things, and it's not one of those films that you should be doing that with. So like, I can't even really give that a score. And then I also watched Obvious Child with Jenny Slate. Have you heard of that?
I have not seen that one, but I've heard
it's
of it.
So good. Like, I loved it. That'll be one of the films I write about for my like 52 films by women. Jenny Slate's just so funny, and like, it's good. It's very good. I think it deserves a little bit more credit. I'd seen one of my friends and fellow film critics on Twitter talking about like it was one of her favorite films directed by a woman. So I sought it out.
I always get this movie confused with the one with Lake Bell about voice acting for some reason.
Oh yeah, I like that too. In a world.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
I'm looking up who directed that, because I feel like I know one of the directors of either one of those movies. Oh no, Lake Bell directed that. So yeah, I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, whatever.
Gillian Robespierre directed Obvious Child.
Yeah, I thought that she also directed something else that I had seen recently, but I can't really see from her Wikipedia page anything. I guess she directed two episodes of A Teacher, which I really liked. But
I've been thinking of maybe watching that. And then the other two films I'll say I watched were Richard Jewell, which I loved way more than I thought I would.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good. And it tells a really interesting story. And then, of course, I Care a Lot, which is getting a lot of buzz because it just came out this weekend, which I also loved. I love Rosamund Pike. I think she's amazing. I thought it was a really fun watch. Like it grips you from the very beginning and then holds on literally until the last few seconds. I mean, you're just like,
I'm very excited about that one.
Have you seen it?
I'm watching it tomorrow.
Okay. Because
yesterday, my girlfriend wanted to watch something a little more tamer, which is what I'll be talking about. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I love Rosamund Pike, and it kind of seems like a spiritual successor to Gone Girl. I know since you're a huge Fincher fan, I'm sure you love Gone Girl.
I love Gone Girl, yeah. Well, it's so funny because you can't help but when you hear her voice, you can't help but hear Amy Dunn. You just can't. Like that voice is Amy Dunn. So I'll be super looking forward to your thoughts on I Care a Lot. I won't say anything else. It really, like I said, it grips you from the very beginning and holds you on to the last few seconds. Like I felt fully engrossed when I was watching it. I have a bad habit right now, again, because we're watching so much at home, right? To like maybe be distracted by my phone a little bit.
Yeah.
Not at all with this film. Like I was fully engrossed. So I'll be excited to hear your thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely let you know because I've been looking forward to that one since I've heard about it. Like, I don't know. It actually hasn't been that long since I heard about it. So it's not one of these months and months of anticipation, but anything with Rosamund Pike sounds pretty good to me. So
that's
I Care a Lot on Netflix. Definitely check that out. And I'll mention the other ones that Erica mentioned in the show notes if you want to check out those as well. So the movie that I saw instead of I Care a Lot yesterday is a film called Flora and Ulysses, or Ulysses.
Superheroes stand watch when danger closes in and save those in need. But they have one thing in common. They never show up in the real world. Until Ulysses. Every superhero comes to us with a purpose. We don't always see it at first. Because we don't always know where to look.
Flora!
What is this?
I am Ulysses, born anew.
Yeah, I've been hearing about this, but I haven't seen it. Tell me about it.
Do you know anything about it?
No.
Okay. It is a movie on Disney Plus. It is adapted from the children's novel of the same name. Flora is a 10-year-old girl, and she befriends a squirrel that she names Ulysses, and it turns out that he kind of has superpowers. And that's the movie. She's from kind of like a brokenish family, and it's a coming of age kids film kind of thing. And it's solid. It definitely doesn't transcend being a kids movie. So it's very much a kids movie and all that entails, but it's pretty cute. And, there's a lot of supporting characters that are played by actors that I think are really funny. So, Flora's dad is played by Ben Schwartz, who I think is hilarious every time he pops up in anything. He has a pretty big role in the film, and he has that manic energy that he brings to like Sonic the Hedgehog and John Ralphio and Parks and Rec. So I enjoyed that a lot. Danny Pudi is the villain of this film. I don't know. Have you seen Community?
Yes.
Yeah. So Abed from Community is the villain.
Okay.
And have you seen DuckTales?
Oh, God. Forever ago.
So there's a new version of it. It's on Disney Plus. I think if you're looking for a 20-minute like cartoon to kill time, it's actually pretty fun and really funny. But Danny Pudi and Ben Schwartz play two of Huey, Dewey, and Louie. I don't remember which ones. But Bobby Moynihan plays the other one. And then there's a girl, Webigail, I think is her name. She's played by Kate Micucci. And all four of these people are in this movie. And I cannot figure out why, like whether that's a coincidence, whether that's Disney being like reusing actors that they have a good standing relationship with. I don't know, but they're all in this movie. So this is a DuckTales reunion for some reason. And then did you see The Haunting of Bly Manor?
No, I haven't. Oh, and what was Mike Flanagan's other?
The Haunting of Hill House.
I bought the book and I have the book and I want it. And the book's like really thick. Like it's not.
Yeah, it's like a novella, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not even, it's maybe like just around 200 pages. So I don't know. It's hard. I don't like to get it like sucked into series because then I just, because it's all available, like I can't not binge it. And then I'm like, I just wasted eight hours, but like 8 hours are gone because I didn't do anything else other than watch this. That's why I watch so many films, because I'm like, it's 2 hours of, it's 2 hours and I'm done. So I, and you know what's funny is one of my best friends, Mike Flanagan, was her college boyfriend. He's from, he's from this area. Yeah, he's from this area. He went to Towson, which is like just north of Baltimore. And they're still friends. Like they still talk, they're still friends. Friendly, but anyways, I've completely derailed from what you were getting at. No, I haven't seen.
There's virtually no relationship to this film other than the fact that the creepy boy in Haunting of Bly Manor, Miles, is also in this movie, and he plays a character who is hysterically blind, which is an outdated term for people who suffer neurological damage due to stress. So basically, when he gets stressed, he becomes blind. Seems like it's like an actual real disease. So it's like kind of questionable whether they, have this character pretend to be that as kind of like a comedic bit. But basically, his whole character is that Anchorman 2 bit where Will Ferrell is blind for a little bit. It's just that he's a 10-year-old instead of Will Ferrell. So it's super random. This movie is really random and very bizarre. I think ultimately, it's a bit jumbled. It's a little all over the place with all these disparate elements coming together. But it has a sweet little message about like hope and, never giving up on your family. Pretty pat shit. But what I think is interesting to see about this type of film is that this genre is now using the common consciousness of superheroes and the idea that the MCU specifically is this thing that exists in our monoculture that everybody knows. And so, like, there are direct references to Marvel characters and superheroes. Flora tells her dad that she loves him 3,000, which is obviously from Endgame. It really got me thinking about how interesting it is that there is an entire generation of children whose entire view of the world and entire way that they engage with pop culture is defined by the MCU, right? And so, like, these other movies that are completely unrelated are using the shared collective consciousness to tell their own story and say, this is how kids understand the world is through superheroes. So let's frame a children's coming of age story through the superhero genre. And I think that's really interesting because it kind of reminds me about how, like, when we were kids or when we were younger, everybody knew like the concept of a Terminator or the concept of a Disney princess, right? And so other media could reference those things or those ideas, and we would instantly know what that archetype means and how you can play off of that idea. So it's really cool to see that happen with the MCU so quickly. And if anything, that's why I found this movie so interesting. Can't say I would like recommend it to anybody who's like not a child or doesn't want to watch like a children's movie, but it was just really interesting to think about that kind of concept of the MCU as monoculture, you know?
Yeah, I think I'd be lost because I have hardly seen any of those films. They're just not my thing. Like, they're just not my thing. Yeah. I feel so left out because it's so much of like a discussion. And like, I was trying to figure out like, should I watch WandaVision? And I just like,
you should.
But I wouldn't know the connections and the references. It was funny. I was talking with a friend about like, should I watch this? And they were like, well, how like well-versed are you with MCU? And I was like, Deadpool? Like, you know, like,
not in the MCU. So, yeah.
Right. And they're like, and I was like, Guardians of the Galaxy? Like, I've seen those. Like, you know, I mean, I just don't have that knowledge.
But, you know, even if you haven't seen every single one, I think there is this sort of general understanding of like the superhero mythos, right? And it's that this movie is playing with, about like how every superhero has a moment where they have to rise to the occasion. Every superhero has an origin story. All of that stuff is stuff that people know regardless of whether they've seen Iron Man and Captain Marvel and all of those things, right?
Right.
Which is interesting to think about. Because it's the same way that, like, I hadn't seen Terminator until, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, you know the I'll be back, and you know the idea of, like, evil Skynet, and, you know? So it's cool to see that happen in our lifetimes with something that is so relatively recent.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
But anyways, that is Flora and Ulysses. I certainly had more fun thinking about the film maybe than I had actually watching it, but it was pretty funny. It's cute. It's on Disney Plus. You can check it out if you're interested.
Cool.
All right. This has been our review of Nomadland. Erica, thank you so much for joining me again. I thought this was a great conversation, and I feel like yet again, we could have talked for another 2 hours.
Yes. Thank you again so much for having me. I'll look forward to, again, the next time we chat about something. You picked all really great films to chat about with me. So like, I love that. I love being able to, you know, talk about just like different ideas and get different perspectives. And you know, again, like, it's so interesting to hear, I think, people, what they probably think about Nomadland, that like, oh, it looks like nothing really happens. But look, I mean, like, look at us. Like, we talked for 2 hours about this film. Like you said, we could have talked for two more. I just think there's so much depth there. And I'll be really excited to see how it does in all these big award shows. I think it's going to clean up. We'll see. I don't know. I loved it. So if you haven't watched it yet, make sure you watch it.
For sure. Fingers crossed. Is there anything specific that you'd like to plug here other than for people to watch Nomadland?
Yeah, watch Nomadland. You can, again, follow me at Erock Reviews on Twitter. I have my link tree on there so you can see all the places I write at. Look out for my South by Southwest coverage, like the middle of March. I'm super excited about that. All my reviews will be at In Session Film, for that. So I can't wait.
Awesome. Thanks, Erica.
Yeah.
The intro music for this episode is a piece called Work by Kevin MacLeod, and you can find more of his work at incompetech.com. If you'd like to keep up with this podcast and find out when I release new episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at MovieMaraPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/MovieMaraPod. That's Movie M-A-R-A Pod. And you can always reach out to the podcast via email by contacting MovieMarathonersPod@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast online at evergreenpodcasts.com/movie-marathoners or wherever you listen to podcasts. So please subscribe or write a review if you like the podcast, and any feedback you have to help improve the podcast is always appreciated. So thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next time when I recap the Golden Globes. It seems like it came out of nowhere, but it is next week, so I'm really excited for that. I'll be joined by Dana Nyland to discuss the results of what is probably the second biggest award show, which airs Sunday, February 28th. So based on the nominations, I think that ceremony is going to be quite bizarre, which should make for a pretty fun conversation. So stay tuned for that. Until then, remember that life's a marathon, so let's take it one movie at a time.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.